Welcome back to the Serial Sisters podcast.
Welcome, welcome.
Back for episode 27. I have to say, this past week, it's been like such a weird week. I think something's going on with the moon. Before we started recording, we just talked about how weird, at least, I don't know if we talked, I can't remember if we talked about you, but we talked about how off my week was, but I don't know. The energy this week was weird.
Yeah, I was thinking about how the last three Wednesdays, it's been really, like, I work from home on Wednesdays, and the last three Wednesdays, I have not worked at all, because the first week, it was the insurrection, the second week, it was the impeachment, and the third week, it was the inauguration.
Yeah, I gotta, I don't even want to know what's gonna happen this Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. Speaking of the inauguration, though, what did you think?
I cried. I cried when both of them were sworn in. My favorite part of the entire inauguration is a tie between Bernie Sanders and the poet Amanda Gorman.
Yes, agreed. I will say this, though. I will say this, though. Boy, did people fucking drive that Bernie meme into the ground within, like, 2 hours. It was. It was driven into the ground so quickly.
Just the fact that, like, we live in a period in time where the second you see something, you can just, like, capitalize off of it. Like, Bernie sold those sweatshirts on his website, and they sold out within minutes, and then he donated 100% of the profits to Meals on Wheels Vermont.
And I was going to say, like, at least he donated it, but,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, on TikTok that night, I saw people being like, my mugs,
restocked. Yes, people are, like, making mugs, like, and pins.
People are, like, embroidering shit, and I'm like, how? Jesus. Because I saw it on my TikTok feed, it was some girl being like, they're going up tomorrow, and it was, like, an enameled, you know those, like, camping-style mugs?
Yeah.
It was that, but, like, with Bernie, and it was, like, an illustration of him,
mm-hmm.
not just, like, a picture, and I almost ordered it, but I'm like, ugh, do I really want to spend $20 plus shipping on a mug for a meme that is probably going to be outdated within a week? So it's in my wish list.
I think
I didn't buy it.
If Bernie puts the sweatshirts up for sale again on his website, I would buy one, especially if the proceeds are going. I mean, obviously, I support him, but, like,
yeah,
if that's where the money was going. But if, you know, he's putting 100% of the profits back into a community, I'm like, hell yeah, I'll support that. And it's a cool fucking sweatshirt. So
can I say, there were a few poignant moments that I was, like, crying laughing from the inauguration.
Oh, one that comes to mind.
What are you going to say?
I was just not to, like, maybe interrupt, even though here I am interrupting, but I saw a TikTok, and I didn't see, on Wednesday I had a bunch of Zoom meetings, so I had to have the inauguration mainly on mute. So I was really, really happy that they ended up swearing both of them in before noon. Which is not, you know, that was weird, but whatever. But I saw a TikTok after Garth Brooks, the singer?
Yeah.
Yeah. After he sang, and he is like, he, like, walks past the Obamas, and he's like, oh my god, hey, you guys, and gives them, like, hugs and kisses, and then he goes to the Clintons, and he does the same thing, and then he, like, runs back to George and Laura, and he doesn't have a mask on the whole time, and he's just, like, so excited. And I was laughing because the person that was narrating the TikTok was like, ooh, child, like, you don't have a mask on. You don't have a care in the world. COVID does not exist for you. Like,
well, here was my first one of my laughable moments was just his performance in general. I shared a TikTok you probably saw that was, like, my thoughts exactly when, like, it was a stitch and someone was like, tell me when you knew the bar was super low for men. And then it cuts to Garth Brooks singing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, okay, my most laughable moment was J-Lo's entire performance. Number one, so obviously lip-syncing the whole time.
Oh, I didn't think I watched hers. Actually, maybe I did because, like, I saw the Spanish. She, like, said the Pledge of Allegiance in Spanish or something.
No. Well, okay, so you could tell, too, because the whole time she was, like, quote-unquote singing, it was, like, a very specific tone, and you could hear the auto-tune, like, so clear as day. And then she, like, a couple times, like, randomly, like, shouted something out in Spanish, and the audio was completely different. And then it went back to, like, the auto-tune singing, and I'm like, if you're just like sporadically screaming stuff out, whoever is like in charge of your mic is not randomly like on standby turning the auto tune up and down. It's like obviously lip syncing because she always does. But so I was like dying laughing at that because I saw people being like, she did so good. I'm like, it literally was like pre-recorded. And people were like, no, it was not. I'm like, we watch it, hun. These were like made up arguments I was not really having with people. But anyways. And then when she fucking had the audacity and like, this land is your land, this land is my land, to end it with, let's get loud, like her own lyrics into it. Like, girl, this is not the Super Bowl. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, to like a crowd.
And then A-Rod like fist bumping every single politician there, like their BFFs. And I'm like, guarantee this is like the first, maybe second time you've ever met these people. And the previous time you met them was when like a fundraising event. Like, it gave me very much the same vibes and energy of I laughed about this too a few weeks ago, I remember, but when Mariah Carey and Nick Cannon got pregnant with their twins and the first people they told was the Obamas, who they were like meeting for like one of the first times at some Christmas event. Like, I don't know. I also, though, I just like don't really care for J-Lo in general.
Yeah, I think I have a hard time just like with how we make these big events like so polarized with celebrities, as if that's like...
No. That's not why I disliked it. This is why I dislike it. Not to be mean. J-Lo is someone that is extremely overhyped for being so mediocre.
That's how I feel about Mariah Carey.
Well, no, Mariah Carey, like, does naturally have a very good voice that's just really deteriorated over time. I don't like her as a person, but I'm saying talent-wise. But, like, J-Lo, not a very good actress, in my opinion. She has, like literally been exposed for, like, having other people, like, sing her vocals on songs before. Like, multiple times. So, like, she's not a great singer. She lip syncs everything. And, yeah, I just find her very... I don't know. I just feel like she's one of... She's, like, the... She's, like, just... No. What's a good comparison? She's, like, the music industry equivalent of James Corden, where, like, now Hollywood's putting him in everything. It's, like, J-Lo has to be at every event, and I just can't get behind it. It's just too much. I don't know. And then also, I thought, like, the special, I don't know if you watched that,
at night was, I watched was, some like, of it, but then Earl made me stop because I had been watching CNN for literally 12 hours, so.
Same. it was just, like, too cringy for me.
I liked the idea of where they were going.
I did, too. No, it wasn't, like, it was just, I think it was because we're in COVID times that, like, the performances just felt somewhat off.
Yeah.
Like, how Demi Lovato was, like, very obviously, like, singing in front of a green screen of, like, a landscape was weird. And, like, I love Demi Lovato, but, like, her new hair is not it.
What does it look like?
It's basically, like, a pink haircut. Like, when Katy Perry chopped up all her hair, it's that, but worse. Anywho, why don't we get into today's episode?
Let's do it.
So, this was a case that, like, I've been meaning to cover for, like, the entire podcast.
Okay.
I didn't prepare, like, any kind of special intro, so I'm just gonna say I'm gonna cover the case of Richard Speck.
Oh, yeah. Didn't we talk about this?
We haven't covered him, but I don't know if we talked about him. So let's just jump right in. I will just say, he is someone I am very fascinated by. I mean, I say that every episode, though, like, every person I cover, I'm like, I'm so fascinated by them, but, like, he's genuinely someone that I'm very fascinated by. And, like, I kind of get into the scientific fascinations with him a little bit, but okay. Richard Benjamin Speck was born on December 6, 1941, in Kirkwood, Illinois. He was the seventh child born to Benjamin and Mary Speck. He had four older sisters, two older brothers, and one younger sister who was named Carolyn. His father worked as a farmer, a logger, and a warehouse worker, and throughout his childhood, he had a very close bond with his father, and the two spent a lot of time together. Sadly, in 1947, when Speck was 6 years old, his father died at the age of 53 from a heart attack. Also, though, as we go through this story, I really wonder if his father hadn't died, if he would have turned out the same way. Okay, so a few years after his father died, on May 10th, 1950, His mother remarried an insurance salesman who was named Carl Lindbergh, and Carl was a Texas native. So after the two wed, Speck and his youngest sister moved with their mother to Santo, Texas. So after a little over a year of living in Santo, the family moved to Dallas, and they moved around like the metropolitan city pretty often, or like the metropolitan area. Over the course of like a 12-year period, they lived in 10 different houses. They moved all the time. So Speck's mother was super religious and conservative, and then Carl, his new stepfather, drank really excessively and had a 25-year-long criminal history, which included multiple drunk driving arrests. So essentially, Carl was like the complete opposite kind of person that Speck's father had been. Speck absolutely hated Carl, who he was often emotionally abused by. And then like Carl would often just like make fun of him and then just like threaten him randomly. So, and then at the age of 12, Speck began drinking alcohol at 12 and also began getting into more and more trouble. And he like, which all led to him getting arrested for the first time at age 13 for trespassing.
It always amazes me when kids are like really getting into drugs or alcohol at such a young age. Like,
I know, like, I think that like sixth grade, you're cracking open a cold one.
Like, obviously it happens. And obviously there's, you know, trauma and things involved too. But as a kid, yeah. I remember, like, the only time that I would have alcohol as a child is, like, wine on Christmas diluted with Sprite. Mm-hmm. Or, like, a yes. sip of beer.
Or if dad was, like, yeah, a sip of beer. Yeah. But, like, I don't know. Well, like, obviously we had probably a very different childhood than, like, you know, he had at least. But, like, I just... seeing where I was, like, maturity-wise and remembering where I was maturity-wise at 12, it's just, like, the craziest thing to me to think of, like, you know, someone that age, but... So, Speck attended, like, the Dallas public school system from 4th to 8th grade, and he really struggled academically, so much so that he had to repeat the 8th grade, and then, reportedly, because he refused to speak in front of the class because he feared people staring at him. So that's why he failed. So at 15 years old, he was getting drunk nearly every single day and continued to rack up a criminal record. So he's like already an alcoholic at 15.
So sad.
I know. In 1957, he started his freshman year at Crozier Technical High School. Unfortunately, he failed every single subject in his first semester, and then he didn't go back the second semester. And by 16, he officially dropped out of school. Over the next few years, he worked various odd jobs and racked up a dozen arrests. His mother and stepfather Carl finally separated, and then, like, Carl peaced out and decided to move to California. So, in August of 1960, Richard began working at the 7-Up Bottling Company in Dallas. He did pretty well in this position and ended up actually working there until the summer of 1963. Now, in 1961, he attended the Texas State Fair, where at 19 years old, he met 15-year-old Shirley Malone, and the two quickly began dating. After a whirlwind 3-week-long romance, Shirley became pregnant.
No.
After 3 weeks. So because of this, she moved into the home Speck shared with his mother and his sister, Carolyn, and brother-in-law. On June 19th, 1962, Richard and Shirley married. Mm. And they welcomed their daughter, Robbie Lynn Speck, on July 5th, 1962. However, Speck was not present at the birth because he was serving a 22-day-long jail sentence for disturbing the peace after a drunken arrest. I just feel like that's another example of the type of person he was, because the people you hear about or know of that are like 19... even, like, seniors in high school that would, like, go after the freshmen, like...
yeah, and you're like, why?
You know what I mean? Like, you knew. Like, you knew that type of person, and they weren't, like, winners.
Yeah.
All right, so a year later, at 21 years old, Speck was sentenced to 3 years in prison after he was convicted for forging and cashing in a co-worker's paycheck and burglarizing a grocery store. He served 16 months at the Texas State Penitentiary in Huntsville before he was released on parole on January 2nd of 1965. Exactly 1 week later, on January 9th at 2 in the morning, he attacked a woman in a parking lot with a 17-inch knife.
Oh my God. I'd be like, stand away from
me. Also, a 17-inch knife sounds humongous.
Yeah.
That's over like a foot long. Is the blade 17 inches? No, is that I what think, that means? Because no, that's think, like a sword at that point.
I think including the handle, it's probably 17 inches.
That still seems real long. So a few minutes before police arrived at the scene, he fled. However, they quickly found him and then arrested him for aggravated assault and a parole violation. And he was sentenced to another 16 months in prison, which he again served at the prison in Huntsville. He was paroled after 6 months and released in July of 1965.
And that's another thing, too, is like he's just in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. And if this system truly worked.
But also, though, like a lot of his arrests were like misdemeanors up until this point. Like it was like trespassing or just like vandalism. So I mean, the thing with the knife was like his first big like escalation, I think. So after his release in 1965, he was hired by the Patterson Meat Company as a delivery driver. Within 3 months, he had gotten into 6 accidents and was finally terminated after he didn't show up for a shift. I'm like, I love the fact that he was fired after 3 months because he didn't show up for a shift, not because he got into 6 accidents.
And why was he getting into accidents? Was he drunk or was he just not a good driver?
I don't know. Or just maybe not a good driver. But, like, that's literally, like, an accident every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Got my paycheck, another accident. Like, So, around this time, Speck and Shirley separated. So, he then moved in with a random 29-year-old single mother of 3. And basically, she let him live there under the condition that he babysit her kids while she worked her bartending job at one of his favorite bars, which was Ginny's Lounge. So a month or so later, he went to Ginny's Lounge and then he got into a knife fight and stabbed a guy. So he was arrested again and charged with aggravated assault.
Yeah. And the lady was like, where are my kids?
Yeah. But I'm just like, how sketchy of a situation that you're like, sure, like come live with me and my kids. You can live here for free. Just like take care of the kids.
Yeah. Some random guy that I just.
Sketchy on so many levels. After his arrest, his mom paid for his defense attorney, who was then able to get the assault charge reduced to disturbing the peace. So Speck was found guilty, and he was fined $10, but he didn't pay it. So they arrested him, and he spent three days in jail for that.
For a $10 fine, yeah. Now you get like 3 years, and it'd be like a $10,000 fine.
I know. So a few months later, in March of 1966, things seemed to be looking up for Speck, and he had managed to gather enough money to purchase a used car. The night after he purchased the car, he drove to a grocery store where he stole 70 cartons of cigarettes, then proceeded to sell the cigarettes from his trunk in said store's parking lot, and then abandoned his car. So, like, the police were obviously called, and they were able to trace the car back to Speck, and they then issued a warrant for his arrest on the charge of burglary. At 24 years old, his arrest would be his 42nd arrest in Dallas.
There should be like a, once you've hit 10.
10.
Like, you're done.
Like, 4 and 24 and 42nd arrest?
No, I don't know.
And like his first arrest was at age 13. So in 11 years, he was arrested 42 times.
That's crazy.
So because it was his 42nd arrest, this most likely meant he wasn't going to be able to, like, wriggle his way out of this charge like he had the last one and would most likely get sent to prison this time. So his sister and his mother helped him come up with a plan. So on March 9th of 1966, his family drove him to a bus station in Dallas where he boarded a bus and headed for Chicago.
Oh, is this the... I think I know who this is now.
I'm sure you know this one, but yeah. So, in Chicago, he stayed with one of his older sisters, Martha Thornton, and her family. After a few days, he headed for his childhood town of Monmouth, where he stayed with a few family friends. His older brother, Howard, still resided there, and he worked as a carpenter, so he managed to get Speck a job with him. A few weeks later, Speck received news that his ex-wife, Shirley, had remarried, and this basically sent him into, like, an angry, drunken episode that lasted over the course of like a few days and then reached its climax when he ended up threatening a man at knife point in a bathroom in a bar. Yeah, so he was arrested and then he spent the night in jail until he sobered up. So then, in the middle of the night on April 3rd, 1966, Speck broke into the home of 65-year-old Virgil Harris. He tied her up, blindfolded her, raped her, then tore through her home where he stole $2.50 that she had made from babysitting earlier that night, and then he fled the scene. So Virgil, poor Virgil, was able to contact authorities, and she described her attacker as a 6-foot-tall white man who, quote, spoke very softly with a southern drawl. So on April 9th, Speck visited Frank's place, which was a bar he frequented, where near closing time, he saw 32-year-old bartender Mary Kay Pierce leaving the bar for the night. So, like, not all the details about this instance are, like, super clear, but basically what we know is that somehow Speck got Mary away from, like, public view and then beat her to death. And he hit her so hard in the abdomen that her liver ruptured, which was technically the cause of her death. He then placed her body in an empty hog house, which he had helped build at his carpenter job that was located directly behind the bar. So Mary Kay was reported missing on April 13th, with her body also being found that same day. So because of his connection to, like, being part of building the hog house, police did question him regarding her death. But after he collected his paycheck on April 15th, he skipped town. And then after learning this, police investigated the boarding room he had been staying in, where they discovered multiple personal items that had been taken from Virgil Harris's home during her attack. So a week later, he arrived back in Chicago to stay with his older sister Martha, who worked as a nurse, and her husband Gene was a railroad switchman, and their two daughters, and they lived in the old Irving Park neighborhood. So his sister and her family were not aware that he fled from Monmouth for killing someone. He instead made up this whole story where he was put in this situation where, because it was so hard to find work and drug use was so high up in Monmouth, he essentially was being forced to sell drugs, which he said he didn't want to get involved in, thus why he had to come stay with them in Chicago, which was, like, interesting because I'm like, you were literally in Monmouth for, like, what, 2-3 weeks? And you're like, oh God, they just really were peer pressuring me to sell drugs and I just couldn't do it. So his brother-in-law, Gene, had actually served in the Navy and thought with his connections, he would be able to get Speck some employment with the Merchant Marines. So Speck applied to the U.S. Coast Guard, and after submitting an application, which included fingerprints, photographs, and, like, a physical, he was offered an apprentice position on Inland Steel's Clarence B. Randall, which operated as a bulk ore lake freighter. Whatever. So Speck left on his first voyage on April 30th. Unfortunately, he got appendicitis, so by May 3rd, they transported him to a hospital in Hancock, Michigan, where he underwent an emergency appendectomy. After some time to recover from the operation, on May 20th, he rejoined his crew and headed off on his second voyage. He was kicked off the voyage on June 15th after he got drunk and got into a fight with one of the boat's officers.
This guy needs to take a break from alcohol.
I know, literally. So he traveled through Michigan for a few weeks, and then by the end of June, he made his way back to Chicago to once again stay with his sister and her family. On June 30th, Gene, his brother-in-law, accompanied him to the National Maritime Union Building at 2335 East 100th Street on Chicago's South Side to apply for a Merchant Mariner's card, which is basically just, like, I don't know. I couldn't really figure it out, but it seemed like it was just a credential that, like, says you have the training to work on a ship. So then a week later, Richard returned to pick up his card, and then he applied for a crew position for, like, an upcoming expedition or whatever. But a seaman with more seniority was chosen over him. A few days later, his sister, like, had essentially told him, like, you've overstayed your welcome, you've been here too long. So then he, like, got his stuff together and then found a boarding house in close proximity to the National Maritime Building, where he awaited news of a crew placement. On July 12th, Speck was notified that he was chosen for an assignment on an oil tanker, the SS Sinclair Great Lakes.
Okay, this is another thing, though. Like, did they not check people's, like, did they not do background checks?
I don't know if, like, it was different back then where, like, I don't know, like, maybe because they were in Illinois, they didn't check, like, state records in Dallas or, like, in Texas. Because, like, I don't know if any of his charges were, like, felonies. So maybe, like, his charges were only, like, state crimes in Texas, so maybe it wouldn't have shown up. I don't know. Anyway, so something happened where, like, he didn't check in quickly enough or something, so they gave his spot to someone else on, like, that crew. So then he ran out of money, so he, like, found an unfinished house somewhere and then, like, slept there for the night. And then he met up with his sister Martha and brother-in-law Gene the next day at an elementary school a block or so from the NMU building. So Martha, his sister, gave him $25 to just kind of help tie him over while he continued waiting for a placement on a crew. They then said their goodbyes, and by 10:30 a.m., Speck lost his patience and took the money his sister gave him to get a boarding house room and then went day drinking. By the evening, I know.
Oh my God, find you another outlet, my friend.
I know. And it keeps happening too. Like, this isn't the end of it. So by the evening, he approached a fellow bar goer, 53-year-old Ella Mae Hooper, by knife point, brought her back to his room at the boarding house, raped her, then stole a .22-caliber revolver she had been carrying. He then dressed in all black, armed himself with his pocket knife, a hunting knife, and the stolen revolver, and headed back out to drink. Around 10:30 a.m., he left the bar he was at and walked about a mile and a half until he made his way back towards the elementary school he had met his sister and brother-in-law at earlier that day. And across the street was where he shit hit the fan, I guess we'll say. So around 11 p.m. on July 13th, 1966, 24-year-old Richard Speck approached a townhouse that served as a dormitory for nursing students located at 2319 East 100th Street. He broke in through a window and made his way up to the bedrooms. He knocked on the first door he saw, and 23-year-old Filipina exchange student Corazon Cora Amaral opened her door to find Speck dressed in all black with a gun in his hand. He then went room by room and herded up the other students, which included 23-year-old Merlita Gargulo, 23-year-old Valentina Passion, 20-year-old Patricia Matisic, 20-year-old Pamela Wilkening, and 24-year-old Nina Jo Schmall. He forced all the girls into one room where he tore up a set of bed sheets and tied up the girls' hands and feet. The girls thought that if they just remained calm and quiet, he would too, and then hopefully everything would turn out fine. Then, Speck led each of the girls out of the room one by one. The girls remained calm as they were taken out, but the girls could also hear muffled cries for help after each girl was taken into the other room. As Speck continued his brutal and vicious attack, Cora Amaral managed to roll under one of the beds in the room they were being kept in. So meanwhile, two other students returned home for the night. 21-year-old Suzanne Ferris was heading towards her bedroom when Speck snuck upon her and stabbed her to death. A minute or two later, 20-year-old Mary Ann Jordan entered the home and Speck attacked her and stabbed her to death. A little while later, 22-year-old Gloria Jean Davey returned home after spending the night out with her boyfriend. Upon her arrival, Speck attacked her, raped her, and sexually brutalized her before he strangled her to death. Because the last three victims arrived at separate times, Speck actually lost count of the number of girls that were in the home, so he completely forgot about Cora Amaral. Cora stayed hidden under the bed until around 6 in the morning. When she finally summoned enough courage to get out from under the bed, she climbed out of a window and screamed, "They're all dead. All of my friends are dead." Which, like, I literally cannot even fucking imagine.
No, imagine how scary that is. Is that the same story from that they, like, tried to reenact on American Horror Story?
I think they took it as inspiration, yeah.
Yeah.
So, a neighboring student nurse, Judy Dykton, heard Cora's tearful cries for help. She ran into the townhouse to help Cora out, and then she ran to the townhouse of Mrs. Bison, who was the house mother. Mrs. Bison, along with additional students, ran to the scene. Cora pleaded with them not to go inside, since at that point she still wasn't certain that Speck had left the scene. A freshman police officer, Daniel Kelly, had been patrolling the area and was flagged down by neighbors. He immediately radioed for backup and then entered the house. When additional officers arrived at the scene, they found Daniel Kelly vomiting outside of the house. When the additional officers entered the house, they too were shocked by the gruesome sight, and the additional officers were so disgusted and distraught by the brutality at the scene and the amount of blood that they too exited the house and vomited. Gloria Davey was found naked, face down on the couch on the first level. She had been bound by a ripped piece of fabric that was tied with double knots and had semen between her legs. On the second level, in one of the bedrooms, investigators found Pamela Wilkinen's body. She had been gagged and had been stabbed in the heart. Close by, they found the body of Suzanne Ferris. She was found face down in a pool of blood and had a stocking tied around her neck. She had 18 stab wounds to her chest and neck. Next to her was the body of Mary Ann Jordan. She had been stabbed in the chest, neck, and eye. In another bedroom, investigators found the body of Nina Schmal. She had been bound with double knots. She had been stabbed around her neck, and her neck appeared to have been broken. Under a sheet, they found the body of Valentina Pison. She was face down and her throat had been slit and had bisected her voice box. Next to her was Merlita Gargulo. She had been stabbed and strangled. In the upstairs bathroom, investigators found the body of Patricia Matisek. She had been bound with double knots. She had been strangled with a bed sheet. So there was blood all over the bathroom, hallways, and bedrooms. The most experienced detectives on the scene felt that this was the absolute worst crime scenes they had ever come across. After the discovery of the crime scene, police officers immediately hit the streets to try to hunt down the perpetrator. Cora told officers that the killer was a man, 6 feet tall, had blonde hair, probably around 160 pounds, and spoke with a southern drawl. Initially, since the victims were all students and the residence was not super well known, like to people that weren't students, they believed the perpetrator had to have been someone familiar with the area. Detectives spoke to a gas station worker who said they had remembered a strange man coming in a few days before ranting about missing a job out on a ship. This led investigators to the Merchant Marine Union Building. But the employee they questioned did not recognize anyone that fit their description. When investigators returned later in the day to question employees, one agent did remember a guy who lost out on a job after it was double booked, and he remembered the guy had a southern accent. He pulled out a log sheet and they found the name Richard Speck. They immediately checked to see if he had a record, but it didn't appear he had one since he hadn't been arrested for anything locally. Then they found his sister's phone number and called her, and basically they had the union call her and say, like, hey, we have a job for Speck to ship out on. So they were trying to bait him, essentially. So, like, meanwhile, in the time since the murders, Speck had been out at the bars drinking as he always did. So when his sister called him about the job, he did call the union, but, like, he was none the wiser and suspected that the cops were on his trail. So he packed his bags, got a taxi, and then told the driver to just go to the, quote, slummy part of town. The driver dropped him off at a random building on the north side of Chicago. He found another boarding house and got a room under the name John Staten. The next morning, he awoke to two officers standing over him. They were questioning him about the gun he had stolen. He showed them his ID, told them his name was Richard Speck, and after 15 minutes of questioning, they let him go. Because not all officers in Chicago were aware of the manhunt for him, because the officers that were aware were still actively hunting him down on the south side. Like, they didn't think he, like, left the area. So, like, because of that, they had no need to be like, hey, north side guys. Okay, so after that, he hit the bars again. I just, like, laughed this whole time because he's just, like, literally on the run for heinous and, like, brutal murders. And he's like, I'll just hit the bar.
Don't you think?
What else am I going to do?
Yeah, like, don't you think they should have put some, like, wanted signs up or, like...
Well, it's, like, the next day. Meanwhile, the FBI had been contacted to run his fingerprints through their records because, as I mentioned, the Maritime Union, like, got his fingerprints in his application. So while police started getting hot on his trail and tracing him to the boarding house he rented a room in, somehow he got the inclination again that they were about to get him. So he once again packed his bags and fled. He went to another boarding house and got a bed. He then went out to do more drinking. The next morning, police received confirmation from the FBI that the fingerprints taken from the scene of the crime matched Speck's fingerprints they had on file, and they officially put out a warrant for his arrest. And then the news hit the papers. Speck had gotten up early and pawned off some of his belongings and then started drinking again. He then saw a newspaper with his photo on the front page. So he ran back to the boarding house, downed a bottle of wine in the bathroom, then slipped and fell, smashed the bottle, and then gashed his wrist and elbow and tried to commit suicide by severing an artery. So he was found by, like, a random friend and was taken by ambulance to Cook County Hospital. Now, important to note, Speck had a tattoo, famously, that said Born to Raise Hell, which was a detail that was included on the warrant for his arrest and was, like, obviously written about in the papers and everything. So while tending to his wounds, a nurse, Kathy O'Connor, noticed the tattoo. He asked her for water, and she grabbed him by the neck and said, quote, did you give water to the nurses? It's, like, badass. Then she called the police, and then he went into surgery, and after he got out of surgery, a dozen officers guarded his room. The crime shocked and horrified the entire nation, and Speck's face was plastered on almost every newspaper across the country. With Speck in custody, the judge ordered an official, impartial test to be performed to look into Speck's sanity and competency to stand trial. The panel consisted of three psychiatrists selected by the defense and three psychiatrists selected by the prosecution. The panel were all in agreement and declared that Speck was competent to stand trial and also ruled that he was sane at the time of the murders. While in custody, Speck attended twice weekly sessions with a Cook County jail psychiatrist, Dr. Marvin Zifferin. Dr. Zifferin reported that Speck suffered a wide array of emotions such as depression, anxiety, guilt, and shame, but he had obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. While he seemed to have a deep love towards his family, his attitude towards women were quite negative, and he seemed to harbor a lot of hostility towards them, which, like, no shit. Zifferin also diagnosed Speck with organic brain syndrome due to a head injury he sustained in childhood. Now, Zifferin was not permitted to testify for Speck at trial because it came out that he was working on writing a tell-all book about Speck for his own monetary gain. So, not that it really matters in the grand scheme of things, but Zifferin thought that Speck was competent to stand trial but was insane at the time of the murders, which was instigated by the various drugs and alcohol that had been in his system.
Yeah, okay, but...
I mean, that doesn't mean he's innocent. That just means that, like, he was, like, insane, which, like, I feel like with the brutality of the murders against complete strangers, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with.
Yeah, but I hate when they try to be like, oh, like, he never would have done this if he wasn't drinking.
Well, I don't think that's what that says. No, I'm just saying
there are times where...
Also, he was escalating, though. Like, he clearly had issues prior to this. Okay, so while he was under the care of Dr. Leroy Smith, Speck allegedly confessed to the crimes against him. However, he was sedated at the time, so this was not admissible evidence. And then he also later claimed he had absolutely no recollection of the murders, so.
Yeah, what if you were just like, I don't remember doing this. It didn't happen. And they're like,
yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, we have evidence of you doing it. Well, I don't remember that. Well, we have it on video. It's like, no, you don't.
Well, I think that's where, like, the competency and stuff comes in, but what a fear.
Mm-hmm.
I have such an irrational fear about, like, running someone over and, like, killing them on accident. Like, vehicular manslaughter, I have such a fear of. Like, accidental.
Yeah, watch the show Your Honor.
Ugh. That's what happened to Laura Bush. Yeah. Laura Bush killed the guy. Anyhow. So the trial began on April 3rd, 1967, in Peoria, Illinois. And Peoria was 3 hours south of Chicago, and the trial had been moved there because basically, like, everyone in Chicago knew about the case, so they thought he, like, couldn't get a fair trial there. So the courtroom was packed by the victim's friends and families, as well as spectators. At the trial, sole survivor Cora Amaral bravely took to the witness stand and identified Speck as the murderer in front of the court. When she was asked to identify the killer, she got up from the witness stand, walked towards Speck, and pointed her finger at him so close that she almost touched him, and told the court, quote, "This is the man." The prosecution detailed how Speck systematically murdered the girls one by one and presented the fingerprint evidence and noted Speck's lack of an alibi. The defense argued that the fingerprint evidence was just, quote, smudges, and suggested that police planted them. Which, like, why would they frame him of all people? On April 15th, 1967, after 49 minutes of deliberation, the jury found Speck guilty on all 8 counts of murder and recommended he face the death penalty. At sentencing on June 5th, 1967, Judge Herbert J. Parchin sentenced Richard Speck to the electric chair. Appeals were immediately filed to the Illinois Supreme Court, which upheld the conviction and officially sentenced Richard Speck to death on November 22, 1968. On June 28, 1971, the United States Supreme Court upheld Speck's conviction, but because over 250 potential jurors were unconstitutionally excluded from the jury for his trial, mainly due to their religious beliefs regarding the death penalty, the Supreme Court overturned his death sentence. Then, on June 29th, 1972, the Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional, so there was no way Speck would be put to death for his crimes. On November 21st, 1972, Judge Richard Fitzgerald re-sentenced Speck and gave him 400 to 1,200 years in prison. While he was somehow eligible for parole with that amount of a sentence, he was denied every single time. Like, I don't understand how you're sentenced to, like, 1,200 years in prison and you're eligible for parole. Explain that to me. So Speck was incarcerated at the Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois. Amongst the other inmates, he was nicknamed Birdman because of a pair of sparrows that had flown into his cell that he trapped. So he was sort of seen as a loner, and he really kept to himself for the most part. He would just kind of hang out in his cell and listen to music. And he also apparently had a stamp collection that kept him occupied for hours. However, he was by no means a model prisoner. They caught him with drugs and with homemade moonshine, like, literally all the time. I didn't write about this, but he was part of the John Douglas Mindhunter, like, behavioral science unit interview thing, and he was portrayed on season one, I believe, of Mindhunter. Fun fact, I somehow find a way to involve John Douglas in every single case I cover. Unlike a lot of these, like, notorious murderers, Speck was not someone who, like, really wanted the limelight or a bunch of attention, and at least it, like, kind of didn't appear that way. So he typically refused any kind of, like, interview requests he received. The only time he granted an interview was with Chicago Tribune reporter Bob Green in 1978. And in this interview, Speck actually admitted to the murders, which, like, previously he had always said, like, I don't know what you're talking about, I don't remember. And in the interview, he said, quote, I had no feelings at all that night. They said there was blood all over the place. I can't remember. It felt like nothing. I'm sorry as hell for those girls and for their families and for me. If I had to do it over again, it would be a simple house burglary. And then he was asked his final thoughts for the American people, and he said, quote, just tell them to keep their hatred up for me. I know it keeps up their morale, and I don't know what I'd do without it. So then for about like 20 years or so, the public didn't really hear anything about Speck or his prison life. And then, but in the spring of 1996, and this has to be one of the weirdest things I've like ever heard about in a true crime case. In the spring of 1996, an anonymous attorney sent in a tape to Chicago News anchor Bill Curtis. And the tape was filmed at the Stateville prison in 1988. What was on the tape both shocked and infuriated state legislators and the public. The footage showed money and drugs such as cocaine being passed amongst inmates, inmates engaging in sex, including Speck giving another inmate oral sex. Speck was seen wearing silk panties and appeared to have breasts, reportedly due to hormone treatments that had been smuggled into the prison walls. And then Speck could be on her tape saying, quote, if they only knew how much fun I was having, they'd turn me loose. And then an inmate asked Speck why he killed those girls, which Speck jokingly replied, quote, it just wasn't their night. Then when he was asked how he felt killing them, he said, quote, like I always felt, had no feeling. If you're asking me if I felt sorry, no. And then he went on to talk in detail about how it feels to strangle someone. So obviously, as I mentioned, this tape caused a huge uproar. It was not only upsetting to the public and the state officials and legislators, but it was also extremely upsetting for the victims' families. Now, there was some debate regarding the hormones Speck was taking. So some investigators believed that Speck was not taking the hormones and wearing the silk panties by his own accord. People were essentially of the thought that other inmates were forcing him to do it, or he did so as a way to survive in prison. But, like, weird tactic, bro. So, on December 5th, 1991, Speck was taken to Silver Cross Hospital in Joliet after complaining of chest pain and nausea. After suffering a heart attack, Richard Speck was pronounced dead at 49 years old, just one day shy of his 50th birthday. After his death, which, like, honestly, I'm surprised he didn't, like, die earlier with the amount of drinking he did from, like, liver failure or something, you would think.
Right, you would.
After his death, neuropathologist Dr. Jan E. Lesma performed an extensive autopsy of Speck's brain. She found there were two areas of the brain that showed gross abnormalities. She found the hippocampus, which is, like, your memory, and the amygdala, which involves, like, really strong emotions like rage. And essentially, these two parts of his brain overlapped one another, which is, like, super unusual. So she made, like, tissue sample slides. However, it's not really clear, but, like, they were either lost or stolen. So her analysis has been deemed as inconclusive. But a few years later, neurologist and director of the epilepsy clinic at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Dr. John R. Hughes, examined photos that had been on the tissue samples and compared them to brainwave scans that had been performed on Speck in the 1960s. And he was shocked by what he found. In his professional opinion, he stated that Speck's criminal acts were the result of the abuse inflicted by his alcoholic stepfather, excessive alcohol consumption, and brain abnormalities that he said he, quote, had never seen or heard of in the history of neurology. So any abnormality that exceptional has got to have an exceptional consequence. After his death, his body was not claimed. While the coroner had spoken to one of Speck's sisters, Speck's family believed that if they were to bury him, like, people would almost certainly desecrate his gravesite. And the family also just, like, avoided any mention of their relation to him. Therefore, Speck was cremated and his ashes were scattered in Joliet by coroner Dwayne Krieger, a deputy and a pastor. And those three individuals are the only one who know Speck's final resting place. And that's the case. I find the brain part really interesting, though.
Yeah, me too.
Because, like, I wonder that, like, that guy said, like, it was a combination of, like, the brain abnormalities, the drinking, and, like, the abuse from his stepfather. So that's why I wonder, like, how he would have turned, like, even with those brain abnormalities, how that would have, like, manifested itself is, like, if his father had never died. Because I feel like if his father hadn't died, he maybe wouldn't have gotten into drinking like he did.
Right, like, past traumatic events in somebody's life.
Yeah. And so, like, that, I don't know. But, I mean, we'll never know, but... Well, thank you guys for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want to stay up to date with new episodes and things we're talking about, feel free to follow us on Instagram or Facebook at The Serial Sisters Pod. On Twitter, at The Serial Sis Pod. You can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. And with that, we'll be back next week. But with that, for this week, we will bid you adieu. We will say sayonara.
Adios.
Bye, sister.
Bye.